Ms. Burrows?
Good morning, judges.
Ready when you are.
I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
3 minutes, yes.
Good morning, judges. May it please the court. My name is Joan Burrows, and I'm here representing Javon Bass this morning. We are asking the court, initially, I know there are two assignments of error. I will tell the court with regard to the sufficiency of the evidence. I would rely on my brief in that regard. I think the primary issue and the most important issue here this morning is the fact that he was convicted of a much more serious crime than what he was charged with. As the court's well aware, he was indicted for the attempted robbery of Vidal Smith, was ultimately found guilty of a completed robbery of Vidal Smith. I think that that is certainly an error, while not preserved below, that needs to be corrected by ends of justice review here. With regards to ends of justice, the case law requires that we prove not only that there was an error committed, but that error was a substantial miscarriage of justice. Clearly, the error here is the variance between the indictment and the ultimate finding of guilt. I understand that this was probably a very confusing case, both to try and review. First and foremost, two of the victims shared a same last name, and I think that same last name was probably what caused this error. But at the same time, it was the Commonwealth's burden. The Commonwealth decided to bring all three charges separately rather than going under a single concert of effort charge, and for that reason, it was their burden to make sure that all their I's were dotted and all their T's were crossed, and unfortunately they weren't. So that certainly is an error. The miscarriage of justice, I think, is best demonstrated by looking at the difference between an attempted robbery and a completed robbery. An attempted robbery is a class 6 felony that carries a maximum penalty of 10 years. Completed robbery carries life. Most significantly, I think, is the fact that this makes Mr. Bass a Category 1 offender. I'm not sure how familiar the court is with sentencing guidelines, but that is a significant factor. I don't know if the court would be willing or able to look, just for demonstrative purposes, a couple of the sentencing guidelines and the effects that a Category 1 offense would have on him subsequently.
Counsel, you can assume we're familiar with the sentencing.
Thank you.
Counsel, let me ask you, neither you nor the Commonwealth in this case cited two cases, and I want to know if in the course of your research in this case you're familiar with them. One is Ferguson versus the Commonwealth, which was an en banc opinion from this court, citing an earlier opinion, the case of Leggett versus the Commonwealth. Are you familiar with those two cases at all?
I am not, Judge. I'm sorry.
Okay.
If the court wants,
In Ferguson, as I understand it, the defendant was convicted of unlawful wounding upon an indictment that charged unlawful wounding, despite the trial court's oral pronouncement of guilt of malicious wounding. Nevertheless, the trial court sentenced the defendant in excess of the statutory maximum for unlawful wounding. The defendant raised no objection to the error in the trial court. Applying our holding in Leggett, we considered the issue on appeal and remanded the matter for resentencing in accordance with his conviction for unlawful wounding. And the citation, as I say, was to Leggett in that case. And I came onto those two cases in a shepherdizing way, and I did not understand why neither you nor the Commonwealth addressed either of these cases, but obviously you're not familiar with them, so you obviously wouldn't be in a position to do that.
And I apologize, okay. Judge.
Thanks.
I do think the two cases that are important to this for the court to consider are the Cunningham and Henson cases. I think both of those cases kind of carve out a nice little niche that this case falls very neatly into. In the Cunningham case, that was a Supreme Court case that was brought to them not on direct appeal, but by habeas. A habeas corpus proceeding. There, the court posited that had this issue, it was a similar issue where the defendant was indicted on one charge, found guilty on a different charge. The court there posited that had the issue come up on direct appeal, it would perhaps have been an appropriate time to address it. The Henson case, which came after the Cunningham case, I think that they were getting closer. Unfortunately, in that case, it was very clear from the record that the trial court was aware of the issue and defense counsel simply chose not to address it. So I think there, the Supreme Court said, had that not happened and had this, in fact, not been addressed, then that would put us in a different position as far as being able to correct this on appeal. And so I think that's where we are today. Certainly, nobody at the trial court was aware of the variance between the indictment and the ultimate conviction. It was not brought up, unfortunately. I think had it been brought up, it certainly could have been corrected, but since it wasn't, we're left in the position where we're asking this court to reverse the trial court's decision and remand it for a new trial. I certainly understand that we're not in a position where we can ask for the case to be dismissed, but I think that that is an adequate way to address this. I think what's also important to consider is that the sentence that the jury recommended and that was ultimately imposed was 10 years. They were assuming a robbery conviction, and certainly 10 years is the maximum for an attempted robbery, but the jury was assuming that this was a robbery conviction. They could have given him life. They didn't. And so I think that you're in a position where the jury didn't choose to maximize the sentence, and so certainly we need to have a new sentencing hearing at the very least to have that appropriate information in front of the jury. Just a few things I would like to point out with regard to the Commonwealth's brief. Commonwealth indicated that the ends of justice, or argued that the ends of justice exception would only be applicable if there was no criminal behavior found whatsoever. I think that, even though it relies on the Redmond standard, which I cited in my brief, is an inappropriate standard in this case. I cited it for the purposes that that the ends of justice is a very narrow exception. But the Redmond case deals with the sufficiency of the evidence argument. That's not where we're at with this assignment of error. This is a variance between the indictment and the ultimate conviction, and therefore I don't think that there is a requirement that there be a total absence of criminal behavior. And additionally, the Commonwealth, I think, takes a broader view of what I'm asking the court to do. I'm not asking for new law. I'm asking the court to apply the ends of justice exception. I think it's absolutely applicable in this case. I think that Mr. Bass is entitled to be at least statutorily entitled to be told what he's charged with.
Counsel, what's your best ends of justice case that you think applies here?
I think that comparing I know they're not ends of justice cases, but I think applying Henson and Cunningham and kind of seeing the niche that they carve out, that leaves us with the ends of justice fix here. I think the Supreme Court was kind of perhaps dreaming of this case when they cited these two, or they made these two opinions, and I think that this case is ripe for the ends of justice exception. So I would ask the court again, I agree that it's not preserved below, but I still think that Mr. Bass is entitled to have this fixed, and I would ask the court to address it.
Thank you. Ms. Bourne.
May it please the court, my name is Rosemary Bourne, and I'm here on behalf of the Commonwealth of Virginia. Judge Clemens, if I could address your question. Yes. I did not believe that those cases were applicable to this case because the alleged variance here was a name switch. It wasn't that, it was like a typographical error. And everybody apparently knew from the beginning that the evidence was that this person was the actual completed robbery. That was the evidence that was actually presented at trial. It wasn't that there was, unlike I believe in Ferguson, where the actual evidence was unlawful wounding, but he just misspoke and sentenced at the end for a different crime.
There's no question about what the record shows as to what the indictment was and what the arraignment was and what the conviction was and what the sentencing was, correct?
There was no question about what the indictment said, I agree. And there was no question that in the opening statements and during the trial and during the sentencing instructions and during closing argument that everybody assumed, without apparently looking back at the indictments, that this man was being charged with a completed robbery against this particular victim, because the names were apparently transposed because they were two separate, they both had the same surname. And I don't know what happened at preliminary hearing, but the problem here is that had there been an objection at trial, and why the Supreme Court of Virginia cases that she cited actually don't help her, they help me, and are controlling in this case, is because had there been an objection at trial raised to a variance, perhaps this could have been fixed if it were only a typographical error. But we don't know. Or perhaps there was some sort of reason why counsel didn't want to object to this, some strategic reason. As noted in
Can you Henson, imagine any kind of a strategic reason for this?
Well, because at that time there were two indictments pending. There was a completed robbery against another person and only a attempted robbery against somebody else. So both of those indictments were pending at the time. Now, ultimately, the jury came up with some different conviction. They didn't, I don't believe, convicted of the attempted robbery. But, of course, at the, before it went to the jury, nobody knew how that was going to come out. So he may have decided... chances are that, you know, it's going to be switched back around and that would be harmful to me. I'd rather have this other thing go forward against, or not go forward against the other victim.
Well, Leggett, though, you say you're familiar with both Ferguson and
Leggett. I'm familiar with Ferguson.
All right. Well, Leggett, the defendant was indicted for unlawful wounding, pled not guilty to that offense. At the conclusion of the case, however, the trial court stated it found the defendant guilty of malicious wounding. The conviction order stated that the defendant was guilty as charged in the indictment. The trial court sentenced the defendant to 6 years with 4 years suspended. At no time in the trial court did the defendant object to the pronouncement of guilt for malicious wounding or to the sentencing for malicious wounding. When raised for the first time on appeal, this court applied the ends of justice and reversed and remanded.
But I think,
aren't we bound by Leggett?
I think that I would argue that this is a fatal variance argument that has been presented, and that that is different from the court sua sponte convicting of something that's not supported by the evidence. This, in this case, the evidence actually did support a completed robbery on Vidal Smith. That was how the jury was instructed, and that's what they convicted him of, was a completed robbery. So...
We also have Hummer versus Commonwealth going back to 1917 from the Supreme Court, where the defendant was indicted for unlawful wounding, convicted of the greater offense of malicious wounding, and the Supreme Court found the appropriate remedy was to reverse the malicious wounding convictions and remand for a new trial on the charges of unlawful wounding.
But that doesn't square with Henson, where the almost the exact same thing that happened in this case happened in Henson, and that took place in 1967 from the Supreme Court of Virginia. And they said it was a fatal variance, and the failure to object to that waives that objection. And it was a more serious crime. In that case, it was the exact same situation as we have here, an attempted robbery and a completed robbery. And that's why I say, argue to Your Honor, that when we have the judge, and I'm familiar with some other cases where, like, one section of a case that you can convict under several subsections was charged, and I think what comes to mind, and I can't remember the name of the case, and I apologize, but there was a case that involved, I believe, assault on a police officer, but something like that. And essentially, there's several ways in which you could violate the statute. And the court convicted under one way, but not under another. And the evidence actually supported the way it was charged, not the way he ultimately convicted. And in that case, I believe he was convicted of something that he didn't commit. But that's not the case here. This is a variance case. So this case is distinguishable, I would argue, from those other cases where it's just the court is misspeaking, the court is finding somebody guilty of something that wasn't presented at trial. The problem here, if there was a problem, was with the indictment and the evidence presented. So it's a variance case, and you have to object to that under Cunningham and under Henson. And there was no objection here. Now, on brief, there is an attempt to say, well, Henson is distinguishable here. I'm saying the opposing side has made an argument that it's distinguishable. And their reasoning is that the counsel affirmatively said it was like approbate and reprobate. But that doesn't withstand scrutiny under 5A18, because the reason we have Rule 5A18 is so that the judge can correct an error. And that may have been possible here, particularly if the names were just transposed, if it was just a typographical error that took place. We don't even know that. I mean, we know that through the brief in opposition, But the opportunity to develop that record was denied because the proper objection was not made at trial. And that is why the proper objection must be made and why 5A18 bars this from review. And I would certainly argue that this is not a miscarriage of justice. It's not a miscarriage of justice because he was actually, the evidence actually supported his conviction for a completed robbery against Vidal Smith. And it supported, although the jury apparently didn't believe it, an attempted robbery on the other victim. And so it's clear that what happened here is that the names were transposed. But we can't have the opportunity to have had that fixed because that objection was not made at trial. I don't think the court wants to hear from me about the sufficiency of the evidence since no other argument was made. But unless you have any further questions for me, I would just ask that you affirm.
Thank you very much. Ms. Burrows?
It's not often I get to say this, but I agree with the Commonwealth. It was not fixed below. And certainly I think judicial economy would have been served had this been noticed below. But what we're dealing with is a gentleman who was denied his right to be informed of the charges against him. That, to me, is a miscarriage of justice, and that's why we're asking for the ends of justice exception to apply. I don't think that somebody walking away with a violent Category 1 offense, to me, there's no bigger miscarriage of justice. There's a lot of talk about this being a typographical error. It very well may have been, but unfortunately, we're dealing with somebody's life here. Commonwealth brought these charges. It was the Commonwealth's responsibility to make sure, again, that their I's were dotted and their T's were crossed, and that didn't happen.
Counsel, you will admit that there have been cases of constitutional error where the court has chosen not to apply ends of justice.
Sure. I understand that.
How is this case different?
Well, I think it's different because even though this was not preserved below, I think that the record is very clear. I think we don't have to get past the first several pages of the joint appendix. Indictment says one thing, verdict says something else. It's very clear. I'm not putting you in a position where you have to guess as to what happened here. I think it's very clear, and for that reason, I think this is an appropriate case for the ends of justice exception.
But isn't that your point that you just made? Doesn't that suggest that it's a fatal variance in the indictment, which requires an objection below?
It does require an objection, but I think the fact that we have somebody that was found guilty of something substantially different than what he's charged with, that begs for the ends of justice exception. So I would ask the court to apply it. With regard to the evidence supporting a robbery versus an attempted robbery, I think the confusion that clearly counsel and the court was operating under with regard to their last name has to put some doubt into the jury's consideration here of whether there was completed or an attempted robbery. I think looking at the evidence in the case with regard to actually Vidal Smith, the person that he was charged with attempting to rob, that evidence supports an attempted robbery. I think that was the gentleman who came out of the room. There were some discrepancies as to whether he was ordered to go back into his bedroom to get his wallet. It was not very clear whether the wallet was actually taken. The other two gentlemen, Mr. Smith and Mr. Brown, both very clear that that may have been a completed robbery. So I think that there's clearly some confusion by the trial court, and I would assume that that confusion would bleed to the jury. So I don't think that putting faith in the fact that the jury found him guilty of completed robbery fixes anything. So I would ask the court to apply the ends of justice exception and reverse the trial court and remand for a new trial for Mr. Bass.
Very well, thank you. The case is submitted. We'll come down and